Hi, I'm Perry, and you're listening to The Beauty Brains. Hello and welcome to The Beauty Brains, a show where real cosmetic chemists answer your beauty product questions and give you an insider's look at the cosmetic industry. This is episode 360. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, and with me today is Valerie George. Hello, Valerie.
Hi, Perry.
Well, Valerie, it's great to see you. And another great thing is we've got a bunch of good questions on our show today, including, can silicones prevent the penetration of peptides into skin? What makes hairspray brushable? Is the Revlon Emissio shampoo safe to use? Does copper peptide turn vitamin C orange? And what are the basic ingredients in a mascara formula? But first, some of our famous chit-chat. Valerie, looks like you're in the lab right now.
I am, but in a little bit, I will be headed to the home city of Perry Romanowski, Chicago.
That's right. How exciting. You're coming to Chicago. We have a trade show here, which is called Teamworks, but it's like chemical raw material suppliers from around the world all converge into Chicago for one day only.
I am excited to go. I've never been. I'm not going for pleasure, although some could say that work is pleasurable.
Sure.
But I am going to help another ingredient company out at a booth. They are shorthanded, so I will be there at the show. And I'm very excited. I'm going to get to meet one of our Beauty Brains fans. She went to the same university I did.
Oh, really?
And she will be working. Yeah, she'll be working at a different booth. And I got connected to her through someone else, and she was like, oh my gosh, I listened to the Beauty Brains, and I was like, that's pretty cool.
Wow, that's great. Well, hopefully we get a chance to meet up, that'll be fun. Now, I'm sorry you're going to miss the social night, which is after, because you know what they're going to have?
Ice cream?
Live band karaoke.
Oh, that's your specialty.
Yes.
I don't know if the Beauty Brains fans know this or remember this, but Perry and I have done karaoke together in Canada at the Handcrafted Bath and Body Guild show.
That's
in 2023.
Right. That was so much fun. Yes.
It turns out Canadians are really good at karaoke.
They take it
very seriously.
Yes, at least the cosmetic chemist Canadians anyway. Or
got smoked. But we did play a lot of Bryan Adams, which is a tribute to the Canadians.
Yes. Well, it was a lot of fun. All right, Valerie, since you're going to be getting on a plane very quickly, let's move right on into Beauty Science News.
This story hit the news this week because a lab, if we can call them that, named Valisure has announced that products contain benzoyl peroxide, which is an approved acne monograph ingredient by the FDA. Some of these products contain trace amounts of benzene, which is a carcinogen. And the world is in a kerfuffle, but everyone seems to be forgetting this is the exact same company that said benzene was in sunscreen a couple years ago. And the FDA basically said, your methods are crap. Stop it.
Yes, well, that didn't stop them because they tested more stuff that they thought maybe they'd find benzene in. And surprise, surprise, they found benzene. And they had to sort of make up this idea that, well, if you stored it in your car at like 70 degrees C for a few weeks, then it'll produce benzene that would be at harmful levels. This seems like a bit of a stretch.
It's definitely a stretch. I was actually quoted in an article today by Beauty Independent where they got some of the perspectives of varying cosmetic chemists. It was really great to see. And I saw Esther Olu, who goes by the Melanin Chemist online, she mentioned that the Valisure people probably have some kind of agenda for posting these studies because they, according to her, she says that the Valisure company actually has patented a technology to stabilize benzene. So they have some kind of agenda in posting these studies, in my mind. Additionally, the FDA has asked them to stop this, and they keep doing it. So what's their motive?
Well, they get a lot of attention, and I'm sure there are lots of companies that would want to employ them or NGOs that want to employ them that will help to scare consumers away from ingredients that have been used in the industry for decades.
Literally since the 60s, right?
Right. And it was an approved drug. And so it's been safety tested and it's
animal tested. It's gone through a lot of testing.
Exactly. And this is more testing than even cosmetic ingredients because benzoyl peroxide is a drug active. And so they have to go even further steps in testing. So this is a big bit of a nothing burger, but, you know, they could get a lot of attention, I guess.
Yeah, it's all over the place. Now, they filed a petition against the FDA to recall benzoyl peroxide treatments found in their study. Do you think the FDA will do that, or the FDA will say, hey, didn't you listen to our last 483 warning letter? Knock it off.
Yeah, I doubt, highly doubt that they would look for a recall, and I'm sure that would be fought by any of the companies who are making these products. I think the FDA, they might take some samples and do some testing, but that would be the extent of it.
Exactly. Well, bottom line, nobody has to worry. If you use benzoyl peroxide, you can probably keep using it.
Yeah, and I will say we did get a question from one of our listeners who said, this new study about benzene formation from benzoyl peroxide, is it true and how harmful is it to the skin? I believe BP doesn't really absorb into the skin. Is that correct? And is it inhaling? She's an aesthetic and esthetician instructor, and she appreciates that our show helps her to be a more educated professional and educator. Mm. So as far as does it absorb in the skin, the concern of benzene has always been inhalation. So this, you're not going to inhale an amount. And also, it's not going to break down. If you're storing these products at regular room temperature or maybe even a little elevated temperature, this is not, you're not going to see a significant amount of benzene in these things.
Not at all.
Yeah. So no, Jackie, you don't really have to worry about that. And it's not going to be harmful to people's skin. Well, you know what else I saw, Valerie? You know how we sometimes will follow court cases?
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, there was some big news that Sephora won its clean beauty case.
I can't believe it. I know we've talked about this case on the show before.
Yeah, it was a little while back. Mm-hmm. And so what happened, a consumer looked at Sephora's clean beauty and they said, hey, Sephora, you've got synthetic ingredients in that clean beauty. We thought it was going to be all natural and free of any potentially harmful ingredients. And Sephora's like, hey man, we told you exactly what we mean by clean beauty and we never say there's no synthetics in there. And so the judge kind of looked at this stuff because this was going to be a class action lawsuit, which in the United States, class action just means you've got a lawyer who was able to get a lot of people together. And then usually what happens is you get a big settlement, the lawyers make all the money, and then everyone else gets.
And then the consumers get $1.23.
Yeah. Right, something like that. Didn't you get some money from a class action lawsuit a few years back?
I've gotten a handful of them over the years from Amazon, from Apple, from, you know, clothing stores where they've identified I've been a purchaser of a product.
Right.
And I filled out a few of them in the past, but I got another one recently and I was like, it's just not worth the 22-cent check I'll get in the mail.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of effort. And so generally in these class action lawsuits, the first people to sign up, they sort of get more money than like everybody else, but really the lawyers get the most amount of money. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the judge looked at this and they said, you know what? They make a definition for clean and they never say it's all natural and free from any potentially harmful ingredients. And so for that reason, this was thrown out of court.
Well, even though I don't necessarily agree with the basis of the lawsuit, I'm a little disappointed and I think I'm allowed to be.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I hate these clean beauty lists because these brands don't know anything. And there's a certain seal of acceptance. I've been going head to head with them because they don't allow formaldehyde donors, but then they allow hydroxyethyl cellulose, which depending on the grade you use can have a formaldehyde donor present and they don't know what I'm talking. It's just like all this crap is ridiculous.
Yeah, you don't have scientists putting together these lists and that's because, you know, scientists are not motivated to scare people, whereas some of these NGOs and some of these retailers are kind of motivated to have consumers be afraid of their products, so they'll either purchase more expensive products or they'll drum up donations for their cause. And so I am in agreement with you. Although I would have thought this would have been a bad precedent for this lawsuit to go ahead, because on its face, it is kind of ridiculous, because Sephora certainly has, you look on their website, it says clean at Sephora, and it lists out exactly what they mean by that. And so at least they're clear about what they mean.
Even if the list doesn't make sense.
Right. Even if it doesn't make sense. It
doesn't have to make sense. They just have to be forthright.
Right. Yeah. So there is that. So that's interesting to see what will happen with that. But I think that case is dead.
Case closed. There was one more interesting piece of news. A couple fans notified us about this, but we were already all over it. The Rock came out with his own skincare line. And when I saw this news, I was like, wait a second. Didn't one of us predict this?
I thought one of us did predict it.
I felt like we talked about it and then we laughed. Maybe it never made a show, but I feel like we did.
You know what? I did not get a chance to go back and listen to our last show of the year last year, so I will have to go back and do it and report on it next time. But indeed, The Rock said he is debuting a skincare line, which will be interesting. Let's see how many products, like, what's the products too? So it's, their tagline is, and it's called Papa Tui. I guess he's kind of Hawaiian too, so I think that's kind of
it looks kind of neat. Right? And they're all at Target, by the way, which is pretty cool. So that means it's somewhat attainable.
It says the tagline is "Take better care," and it's a men's-focused personal care brand featuring a range of body, hair, and tattoo care products. Interesting.
Dwayne launched the line because over the years, he's had the opportunity to work with a lot of great groomers for different photo shoots and movies, and they've given him a lot of tips. So he thought, this is really incredible. I'll use some of these tips I got to start the line. So for example, he actually has a toner, a face cream, and an eye roller, and he puts all of them in the refrigerator because he loves the cold sensation. And he actually likes to use a cold cream before bed. He's a cold cream guy.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work. But when you're a Hollywood guy and you make your money with your face on TV or on a movie screen, I can understand you wanting to go through all these extra steps.
Well, he has a funny story in at least the Men's Health article where Emily Blunt was talking about skincare and she said, oh, what do you use for toner? And he was like, huh? And she said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you don't use toner. It's going to change your life. And so ever since then, his life has been changed. And so when he launched Papa Tui, he said, you have to have a toner in there. So pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it says Papa Tui is not his first brand endeavor, though. He launched a successful clothing range in conjunction with the Under Armour sporting company. So I miss that clothing range too, but now you can get more of The Rock.
All right. Very cool.
Well, we'll see how long that one sticks around. Good luck to him. Valerie, before we get to questions, remember last time or maybe the show before, one of our listeners asked us about the Tome brand, which is produced by Henkel, I believe.
Yeah, the Tone Cocoa Butter Bar Soap. It was so incredible.
Yes, well, she went that extra step and contacted the company that we told her makes it, and she got a response. Specifically, they said, greetings and thank you for taking the time to contact us regarding All Tone Bar Soap. We sincerely understand your difficulty in finding the product. The overall demand for this product was so slight that it has been discontinued and is no longer available as part of our product line. So, it's officially been discontinued. And, you know, that is also what we kind of predicted of why you couldn't find it anymore, right?
Yeah, well, my mom listens to the show, and she heard that, and she swears that it's at some store, so she's going to check. And I'm going to tell her mom, well, I'll tell her right now, Mom, if you're listening, grab them and put them on eBay.
Right, right, because it's going away. Yeah, it's very interesting. But that is generally, when you can't find a product, it's generally discontinued because the company is just not selling enough of it. The only real other reason would be that maybe a company got bought out by another one or they don't have access to raw material anymore. Mm. We used to produce this product at Alberto, it was a Tresemme leave-in spray, or maybe it was a VO5, Alberto spray leave-in conditioner. And there was this ingredient called Base C. It was like a trade secret ingredient, so we didn't even put it on the label. We just put "and other secret ingredients" or something. Anyway, there was only one supplier for it. And when that supplier stopped selling it, we couldn't make the product anymore. So that went away. All right, let's head off to some questions. Our first question comes from a patron, Sean. Sean says, "Hello, Beauty Brains. I'm an avid listener to your show and truly enjoy the dynamic between you both. Adds so much fun to the science of beauty. I have two questions I hope you can shed some light on. First, can the presence of silicones in skincare formulations inhibit the penetration of peptides through the skin's outer layer, and as a result, affect the rejuvenating benefits? And two, I've had positive experience using eye creams with palmitoyl tripeptide 1 and palmitoyl tetrapeptide 7. Could you share some insights on these peptides? Thank you for your engaging content and looking forward to more discoveries and insights. And I hope Stash returns with a lab full and a full belly." Have you seen Stash recently?
No, but I've seen his sister, Pretty Kitty, and a potential brother, but Stash.
Well, hopefully he comes back. Okay, he actually gave us the formulation ingredients. So there we go. Okay, let's do that silicone question first. Now, silicones are in skincare products generally to form a film, to help form a film, and it also helps to add to the slipperiness when it's being put on the skin.
Some gliding aesthetics,
and a little shine. But so that's generally why they're in there. So what about this question of blocking penetration? What do you think of that?
I don't really think so. The silicone, it's not like you're putting a silicone neat or purely or directly onto your skin.
Right.
And then you're trying to put something on top of it. The silicone droplets are dispersed within the water phase of the formulation within emulsifier. And so the peptides are not blocked by them.
Right.
Once you break this cream over your skin, everything's going to kind of spread out. And the peptides, you know, might not be next to a silicone droplet, or they might, or whatnot. So I don't think that has anything to do with it. What do you think?
Well, I could see the concern. There are a lot of silicone products which are chemical protectants. And so if you're going to expose your skin to chemicals, sometimes people will coat their hands in these silicones, and that does sort of block chemicals in. So logically, I can see there could be some concern about that. But as you said, these are formulated into the product, and so the peptides and the other active ingredients are going to have a chance to be exposed to the skin before that silicone makes a film on the skin. It takes some time for that film to set up, and so I don't think this would inhibit it.
Even silicones as protectants, I think the monograph level for that is like 25%. So we're talking a lot of silicones. In a cream, we're talking a couple percent or less of silicones. And some of them might be volatile. They might flash away into the air if they're just there for spreadability. So I wouldn't be too worried about that.
Having said all that, I would, since it's very difficult to show huge benefits from peptides in skincare anyway, I don't think you're going to notice the difference whether there's a silicone in there or not. I don't know.
Oh, there's Perry, the peptide skeptic.
A peptide skeptic. That could be some sort of portmanteau. I'll have to think of that there.
Yeah, I was trying to think of one as well. Well, the peptides, Sean, that you're enjoying, palmitoyl tripeptide 1 and palmitoyl tetrapeptide 7, these are really OG, original peptide blends from a company called Sederma, which is now owned by Croda. But the blend that you're really enjoying is called Matrixyl 3000. This is one of the most original Matrixyl blends that there is.
Probably one of the best selling in the cosmetic industry too.
Oh yeah. And the benefit of using this peptide is that according to the supplier, it activates the cutaneous repair process, which then helps promote wrinkle smoothing and improves tone and elasticity. And how the supplier is alleging these peptides can do this. So these peptides are very tiny. So one is a tripeptide, meaning it's an amino acid sequence of three amino acids. And palmitate oil tetrapeptide is how many, Perry?
Is that the one, four? Tetrapeptide? Four,
exactly. Yeah. So these are really small molecules, and your skin readily accepts them due to their size and to the amino acid sequence. In this case, there are a few different types of peptides. And in this case, this particular peptide is a signal peptide or a messenger peptide.
Right.
Some of the peptides can be neurotransmitter inhibiting, enzyme inhibiting, and so they, or even a carrier peptide where the peptide's carrying something into the cell. And in this case, this peptide is a signal peptide. And so this peptide is going to go in the skin and it's going to signal to the cell, hey, you should be doing this. You should be activating this. You should be doing that. And so this peptide basically tells your cells, turn on collagen and elastin production. Start dividing cells faster. And the reason it's beneficial to use this as you age is that those mechanisms start to wane as your skin ages. You produce less collagen, less elastin. So the thought is if you could have this signal peptide coming into the skin and telling your skin to, you know, stop being lazy and old, you'll have less wrinkles. Now, the recommended use level is 3% of these blends, which is pretty expensive. I'd be interested to see how many brands actually use that level studied by the supplier.
Yeah, that 3% for ingredients as expensive as this would be pretty high. Also, technically, if that actually worked the way they're saying it,
I know what you're going to say. It would be a drug.
Yeah, it would be a drug. So,
look at that. We're completing each other's sentences.
Right. It's that dynamic they talk about.
Almost 200 episodes later.
Right. So, does it really work? Well, the companies put it in there can't really say that it works. The raw material supplier, they can apparently say whatever they want about products, but because it's the liability of who's making the claim goes on to the company who makes the final product, not onto the raw material suppliers. But, you know, if you're having positive experiences with it, you know, it may or may not be the peptide, but, you know, go ahead and keep using it. I'm sure it's been shown to be safe. But although, I have to say, if it's messing with your biochemistry, you know, could you worry about it causing cancer or something? You know, it's supercharging whatever process that the body was shutting down. And I don't know. That's the kind of things that I always worry about when I hear about active ingredients getting into the skin and doing something.
Oh, Perry.
But, you know, if there was a big, wide range of cancer causing by this ingredient, I think we would know that by now, right? It's been around for a lot of years.
I'm a fan of peptides.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, do they work? I don't know. But I like the idea of them at a minimum.
Well, they definitely work in your body. Your body is full of peptides and enzymes.
It's how your cells communicate.
How it all works. Now, the question is, can those things get through your skin down to the bottom layers of the dermis where it's going to have to, that's where it would work. Because it's not going to do anything outside in the stratum corneum beyond, you know, maybe humectancy or moisturization or something like that. But
they're pretty tiny. Who knows?
Yeah, they are tiny. Well, they like to leave that vagueness in our industry just so you have hope and you can believe. There you go. Speak of hope and believe, we've got another question from a patron.
Hi, Valerie and Perry. It's Rumi again. Thank you so much for answering my numerous questions. I love your show and you're so, so helpful. I have a couple questions this week. What makes a hairspray brushable? I've been using this one, Kenra Platinum Finishing Spray 26. Maximum hold hairspray, fast drying, non-flaking, non-drying, humidity resistant, all-day style retention, high shine finish, all hair types.
Well, you know, I'm looking at this one, and it's got hydrocarbon 152A in there. So, yeah, this is it's low VOC one there. Okay, next, keep on going with the question, sorry.
All right. I like it a lot, and even though it's maximum hold, I can still brush it through, even if I put so much on my hair that my hair looks crispy all day. Not what I would normally do. It doesn't advertise itself as a brush-through hairspray front and center, although the brushability, is that a word? is mentioned on the Amazon page in the questions section. However, my issue is the price. I'm trying to find cheaper alternatives. I tried the Tresemme Maximum Hold hairspray and my hair turned into cement and it was impossible to brush. Is there a hope for a cheaper but just as good alternative?
Well, it's interesting that she mentions the Tresemme, because Tresemme also uses the 152A, yeah.
Well, I think the difference would be in the polymers. Well, they use similar polymers.
Probably the biggest difference is the presence of a silicone in the first product versus the Tresemme does not incorporate a silicone into their hairspray.
Nor do they incorporate proteins.
Or proteins, yeah.
Although it's probably the phenyltrimethicone and the PEG-12 dimethicone that are plasticizing those polymers.
Yeah, I think so. And so the presence of the silicones are what makes the comb go through the hair better. The Tresemme product was probably put together as a hard hold thing. So it's a finishing spray. After you've styled your hair, you spray this on and then it's just set, right? Whereas a brushable one is you can spray it and then you can still brush it and it's going to remain flexible until you stop manipulating it. And then over time, the film kind of sets up and so it holds better that way. But that's the main difference there, I guess, right?
Yeah, I find a lot of the older hairspray technologies tend to have that stiff spray because back when those products were created, no offense, Perry, people wanted sky-high bangs and they wanted their perms to be not moving. They wanted that curly hair held.
Well, you know, I recall there were commercials that, in fact, I was involved, I think, maybe I got on the brand after that, but we did a commercial where we had somebody go to Great America. They had their hair done and they sprayed it. And then when they showed a video of them going down around on the roller coaster, and then after the roller coaster, their hair comes out and their hair kind of looks the same, right? And it's all about...
That's pretty funny.
It holds.
Wouldn't be allowed today.
Right. That's not what people are looking for now.
Yeah. So the answer there to this first question is a brushable hairspray probably has a low level of polymers and they have supplemental ingredients, usually silicones, to help aid in combability.
Right.
As far as a cheaper alternative, you'll have to continue to look at different hairsprays for these ingredients and look for silicones in them.
Yeah, I think also look for that hydrocarbon 152A. That typically means that they're not using water in their formula. And so those hairsprays will generally be better for your hair. It's not going to flatten your hair because I'm looking in even in the Tresemme one, it does contain water, which is a little surprising because they're using the 152A. But with the VOC regulations in California, companies have had to start incorporating water because water is not a VOC.
Are terms such as flexible hold or strong hold well-defined and meaningful, or does every brand mean something different when using them? I've been eyeing this hairspray, but it says medium hold, and it's not that cheap either. Next is comb-through finishing spray. Medium hold hairspray for volume.
Well, here's a little secret for you. You know who makes Nexus? The same company that makes Tresemme.
Yeah.
So to see these ingredient lists and how similar they are, you're like,
Yeah, probably not
sharing technologies.
Too much better. Yeah. We always use PEG-12 dimethicone or phenyltrimethicone in our formulation. So I would keep looking for those silicones.
Sure.
As far as terminology, though, I think there's no legal or standard definition for flexible hold, strong hold, maximum hold. It's really, I think, in alignment with the brand's portfolio. So if you have a hairspray that you think is strong hold and you come out with one stronger, you have to come out with a word that qualifies that. Likewise, if it's lighter, it's not necessarily a brand-to-brand strategy.
Right. You can't really compare brands and expect that the hold of one is going to be the same stronghold of another. It's more relative claims, and you're right. There's no legal definition, but I will say each company will come up with a test and a definition for what they mean by stronghold and flexible hold. So there is some definitions, but just not between brands. It's among a brand, it's where it holds up.
Rumi has a few more questions about the Kenra hairspray. Specifically, what is the difference between 80% VOC and 50% VOC? I am imagining the hairspray helps with styling even days after it's been brushed away. Well, let's actually just go back to the VOC.
This is VOC.
Several questions. All right.
The VOC is basically volatile organic compounds. 80% means 80% of that formula is volatile. It'll evaporate off. So 20% is like the hairspray part, and the 80% is the flying off part. When someone says 50% VOC, that means 50% of the formula is just evaporating into the air. The other 50% is staying on your hair, or it's not an organic compound.
Exactly. And in California, they have created the California Air Resources Board, which actively monitors the volatile organic compounds, not just in cosmetics, but in several different industries. And historically, the limit for hairsprays used as a finishing product, or really any product, were 80%. But over the decades, they've reduced this. So previous to that, 55% was the limit. And now they've said, well, hairsprays actually have to go down to 50% VOC to try to reduce the amount of emissions going into the atmosphere. A styling product, on the other hand, can only have 6% VOC. So this is primarily a California regulation, but many other states do follow these guidelines. So in some areas, you can get an 80% VOC. And in other areas, you can't. And in Europe, they love the VOCs. They don't have any. Yeah, they don't care about it. So, which I always find really interesting.
Well, I think it's because in the United States, the car industry, which produces most of these VOCs, they've got really good lobbyists for the government. So they don't get regulated as much. And the cosmetic industry just does not have the same sort of pull. And so it's easier to beat up on the cosmetic industry than it is to beat up on the car industry. So which one makes a more of a difference? Well, it's clearly the cars, but which one is easier to regulate? Well, it's cosmetics.
Some more questions. Am I imagining that the hairspray helps with styling even days after it's been brushed away? Does any of it actually stay? I swear my overnight heatless curls last longer if I use a lot of hairspray in my hair the day before and I brush it before going to bed. Is that a real thing?
Well, the polymer does not disappear, so it's staying on your hair. So I would not be surprised if your hairspray still is affecting your hair a day or so until you wash it again, really.
It's really designed to stick to your hair, for sure. And finally, what do you think about using hairsprays while pregnant? I saw some studies that link it to birth defects for hairdressers. What about pregnant women that only use it for themselves a few times a week? Maybe occasionally we don't aim it correctly and end up inhaling some. Is it best to just not risk it? What do you think?
I don't think this is something people would have to worry about. Even hairdressers, I don't think. I mean, they have ventilated rooms, and so I'm surprised to hear that hairspray use was somehow linked to a study on birth defects and hairspray. That would have been bigger news, I think. So I'm not familiar with that, so that could just be conjecture or something.
The bigger brands are actually having toxicology review, or I should say any brand also selling the exact same formula in Europe, are having toxicology review done as a safety assessment on their formulations. And during this safety assessment, the toxicologist is going to take into consideration the end user. And because pregnant people have to worry about reproductive toxicity and mutagenicity and genotoxicity with their unborn children, they take this into consideration. And so if an ingredient or a finished product or the way a product is being used is not safe for pregnant women, the product wouldn't be allowed to be used or have to bear some kind of warning. So that would be taken into consideration. Now, for smaller brands, maybe they're not undergoing this toxicology review, but for hairsprays, most of the big brands, and by big brands, I mean multinationals, are doing this because they're doing this to reduce risk of health to anyone. Additionally, hairspray technology hasn't really changed for decades.
No.
We're using the same stuff we did, maybe just lesser VOCs than years before, but the polymers are the same, the other additives are the same. You really can't put a lot into a hairspray. And so for that reason, also, I think we have a lot of historical data available.
Yeah, if this was a significant problem, we would have more incidents of problems and be able to connect it better. And you just really can't.
I also have one other comment.
Yeah.
I don't recommend brushing hair after the hairspray has been dried. If the hairspray is still wet, I think it's okay to do.
Sure.
But I think you can cause a lot of breakage on the hair fiber once the hairspray is totally dry and you try to work a comb through it.
Yeah.
Just my personal and professional opinion.
I could see that. I could also see it's not just the hair fiber breakage that could be the concern, but also you know, it sets up that film on the hair. And then when you comb it, you break that film, and then it's going to kind of look like you have dandruff or something, or flakes or something, and that's going to be the polymer flaking off. So that's another issue.
Roomy, once in a while, but don't do that every day, okay?
Valerie, look at this. We have an audio question all the way from Spain.
I was going to say that, too. We are on the same wavelength.
Okay, you could say it.
All the way from Spain.
Hi, Beauty Brains. Good morning. I'm from Valencia in Spain. And I would like to ask you a question about a product that is called 45 Days Total Color Care. This is a conditioning shampoo, sulfur-free from Revlon. It's called Revlonissimo. And this is the product claims to be at a relatively low pH, 4.5. And I would like to know your opinion. Is this safe to use it, or can this be used like every day, or what's your opinion?
Okay, Valerie, we got 45 days of total color care in the conditioner and sulfa 3. So it's the Revlon product, Revlonissimo.
And it says, I like the name.
I think I said it right this time. And it says it has a relatively low pH, 4.5, and is that safe to use?
Absolutely. You want your conditioners to be anywhere between 4.5 and 5.5. And this is so the conditioning agents can actually remain cationic and attach to the hair fiber and do what they have to do. If the pH gets higher than that, they're not cationic anymore, meaning positively charged. And they're not going to stick to your negatively charged hair fiber. So from a conditioner perspective, you definitely want the pH as low as possible. Now, as far as shampoo goes, you can make low pH shampoo. That's totally fine. I don't always like it from a stability perspective because I think sometimes you get bad stability in these sulfate-free systems when the pH is that low. But for the most part, that is also fine. In this particular shampoo, I don't see anything in there that needs to remain cationic except for amodimethicone, which is a color-protecting silicone, which is really incredible. So I don't know why they have it that low, but it could just be this whole low pH protects your hair color, and they can get this 45-day claim.
Another benefit to a low pH, too, is that it helps your preservative system out. When you're formulating, you kind of want to have a below pH of 5, and that reduces the chances of bacterial growth. That range of bacterial growth really is between 5.5 to like around 7. And so one of the things that people do is to keep the pH lower to prevent microbial growth.
But exactly.
I have to agree with you. We formulated our conditioners even lower than 4.5, I think, because to get citrammonium chloride to stick to the hair, it just stuck better when it was at a pH of like 4.
Exactly. We always formulated that low as well. Tried not to do it on shampoos, but we actually did have a couple shampoos like that. Yeah. There's one shampoo you always want to do this with. I think we've talked about it before, ammonium lauryl sulfate.
Yeah, that's right. You got to keep the pH low because
it's super low, or it will release ammonia.
Right.
I've done that before.
You don't want that. So as far as it being safe to use, this is a product from Revlon. Revlon's not going to produce things that are unsafe. You know, they're too big of a company. So, generally, if you're a smaller company, you could worry a little more. If it's a big company, they just do so much more testing than small brands.
Exactly.
Looks like we have time for another one here. This one all comes to us from Germany.
When I'm using a copper peptide serum at night and an ascorbic acid serum the next morning, some areas of my skin turn orange. My guess is that there is still some copper left on my skin, which oxidizes with the vitamin C. I know I could simply wash my face in the morning to avoid this, but I was wondering, wouldn't copper that oxidizes turn green instead of orange? And since the water I'm using to wash my hair contains quite a bit of copper too, should I avoid the acidic hair care line from Redken to avoid a brassy hair color? Thanks in advance for your answer and the great show, Sarah.
Well, thanks for that. Now, I was trying to think of copper and reacting to form a yellowish thing. And there's not really anything that I could come up with where it's specifically that I could see copper peptide and ascorbic acid reacting to form something of that color. That's not to say that it isn't happening. There could be side reactions where that does happen. So it's possible. So it's when you react stuff with copper, it doesn't just turn blue, although that is a common color. You could do something that's yellow too.
Well, I think there's a little conflation here. So yeah. When copper gets oxidized in the presence of oxygen, it turns green. But sometimes copper is the one doing the oxidation. And in this case, maybe the copper is oxidizing the ascorbic acid.
Right.
And it's turning yellow. Now, the copper in the copper peptide is pretty bound to it, but there is some free copper found in those ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's what's happening.
Yeah, it's possible. It's hard to know specifically because you're talking about a chemical reaction here. And generally, we hope that when you put together cosmetics, there aren't any chemical reactions that happen. So we don't spend a lot of time trying to identify the specific chemicals in there that could be reacting. But certainly there could be some reaction with the copper and then other stuff that's in there at that acidic level that you're getting this effect. But that would be my guess.
The next question, should she avoid the acidic hair care line from Redken to avoid a brassy color? Well, I don't think so, because in this case, the citric acid that's in Redken's acidic hair care line is mm-hmm. actually functioning as a chelating agent.
Okay.
And it's changing the way that water is going into hair to improve the fiber mechanics. It's not going to give you a brassy hair color. Brassy hair color is an orange or a reddish hair color. If you had copper in your hair, you would actually get a green color in your hair.
That was also the name of my band when I was in high school, the brassy hair color.
Oh my goodness.
I played the tuba.
Oh my goodness. I knew a brass instrument joke was coming.
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
But anyway, if you actually had copper in your hair and it were to be oxidized by oxygen, then it would turn green. If you are using citric acid and you have some copper in your hair, I don't think it's going to turn the citric acid orange and give you that brassy look, because it has a different structure than ascorbic acid. It's not, when citric acid, let's say oxidizes, it's not going to turn any color.
Right, right. Yeah, I would agree. All right, Valerie, looks like we have time for just one more question.
One more question.
This comes to us from Tracy, and she's from Patreon, too. Thank you, Tracy. She says, "Dear Beauty Brains, I have a three-part mascara question. A big thanks for showing up for regular episodes and answering my lengthy beauty questions previously." All right. Also, it's undeniably great having a host who actually uses beauty products. Please, Valerie, never leave.
Aww.
I use beauty product.
Well, in the summer, beauty products use the shampoo for your entire body.
That's
and
right.
And you use sunscreen from your golf bag.
I do use sunscreen,
and toothpaste.
Too.
There's three.
I do, yeah. And, you know, on occasionally I'm using deodorant, so if I'm going out in public. All right. I've looked at the ingredient lists of many mascaras to my untrained eye. I'm not seeing anything in a mascara formula that isn't in most other cosmetic and skincare items, except maybe the waxes and lots of iron oxide. Maybelline currently has 50 different offerings of mascara on their website. Can they really be different? Can you just explain the basics of a mascara formula? As a makeup artist, I've used a lot of mascaras, and some have a more natural look, and others do allow you to build up the lashes. What is in mascara that makes it lengthening or volumizing or just a thicker formula? And finally, the price difference is extreme, and I would like to help to understand help people understand what they are paying for. Can you compare these formulas? Thank you. Okay, so first, the basics of mascara. How come mascaras have the same ingredients as a bunch of other products?
Well, they're primarily made of emollients, waxes, polymers.
And the most important part, the colorant additives.
The colorant, so, right, yeah.
Right. So you're right. Waxes and more iron oxide. That's pretty much what they are. So it's just they've been designed to work better to stay on your eyelashes, right? Mascara?
Yeah, it's kind of like nail polish or hair color in a way. The base or a lotion or a shampoo, all products kind of have the same stuff in them. To have a conditioner, you need water. You probably need some other solvents. You need a cationic conditioning agent and maybe a protein. Maybe not. That could be just fluff, right? A shampoo has to have an anionic surfactant, an
Sure.
amphoteric surfactant. Hair color has to have antioxidants, the dyes, the
Yeah.
waxes, the ammonia. So I would say the reason all these mascara formulas look similar is because that's just really what a mascara formula is. It's, there's just kind of this basic chemistry that the chemists work off of, and they tweak the types of waxes, the ratios of the waxes, the types of polymers, the quantity of the polymer to give it these different aesthetics. And
Yeah.
probably the amount of water or volatile compounds in them makes the formula a little thinner, a little thicker, glide onto the lashes in a thinner coating or in a thicker coating.
If you think of it like cosmetic recipes as cooking recipes, I mean, everybody who's going to make an omelet, whether you're a brilliant chef or you're a home cook, everyone's going to use eggs and basically the same ingredients. It's kind of how you mix them together where you can make some differentiation in flavor and textures. And that's kind of how the difference is. Yeah, everyone's using the same ingredients, but you mix them into different kinds of ways to get different effects.
Exactly. Now, let's look at these three formulas that range from New Zealand dollars 18 to
Whoa,
$138 to see
138.
which one is better.
Valerie, how much is that in US dollars?
Well, in New Zealand dollars, it's pretty astonishing. And it was no less astonishing when I looked it up in US dollars, which is about $72 at today's exchange rate.
Woo. Wow,
That's a
that's.
lot of money for a mascara.
Oh, is it? It never surprises me to
Oh,
hear
Perry, do you want to buy
expensive.
me this mascara then? Oh,
There you go.
since you're not
Well,
questioning the price. Oh my goodness.
yeah.
Well, let's see what it has in it. I'm guessing the first mascara, Chantecaille, I'm so sorry, Faux Cils. It's obviously French.
Sure. Chantecaille fossile. I took French
exactly. Lash
in high
boosting
school.
with added growth serum. And I'm guessing this is the more expensive one because it has myristoyl pentapeptide 17. Which is a peptide
Sure.
of five amino acids that has some data by the manufacturer of it to show that it helps produce thicker, longer, fuller looking lashes
Is it like
specifically.
a.
Doesn't work on head hair or brow hair, but it's
Sure.
an eyelash claim.
Okay. It's not a prostaglandin booster kind of thing, like mimic
No,
or.
not
Okay.
at all.
Good.
So this
Okay.
one is water-based, like most of them are, heavily beeswax-based, because it forms a great film. It's a good gelling agent.
Yeah.
And it has some thickeners, some stearic acid.
Carnauba wax in there, so it's a blend of different waxes. Oh, it's got the PVP in there. That's the.
Exactly, which is going to help keep everything in place. Some other
Yeah.
incidentals and that peptide, which I guess is what you're paying for. But in this case, I probably wouldn't recommend the peptide in a lash like this. I would recommend the peptide in a serum because the peptide may have a hard time penetrating through thick waxes. Just
Yeah.
saying.
Well, I'd also say is like you're putting the peptide on your eyelashes that's already out of your head, it's or out of your face. It's
Exactly.
not, it's got to get like into the follicle to do anything, if it could even do anything. So it seems like a waste to put most of it just on the fibers.
I'm guessing this is the second most expensive mascara, Hourglass Caution Extreme Lash Mascara. This just looks like a standard issue mascara.
Yeah,
So,
pretty standard issue, yeah.
yeah, it's actually pretty similar to the others, except it doesn't use beeswax. It's, I'm guessing, vegan because it uses Carnauba wax instead, which is a really stiff wax.
Yeah.
It uses PVP, but also acrylates, ethyl hexyl acrylate copolymer, VP eicosene copolymer, acrylates copolymer. So, in addition to hydrated silica. So it has a lot of polymers,
Yeah, a lot
which
of
I'm
polymers in
guessing
there.
is what's going to help give the extreme lash length.
Sure. And then we got the Maybelline Great Lash.
I'm guessing this is the most economic entry point. This one's not vegan because of the beeswax and the shellac, but this is a basic mascara. It has enough waxes and conditioning agents. It has simethicone and quaternium 22, which are going to help it glide over the lashes and
Yeah.
pigment. So probably if you're just looking to give your lashes a little extra something, this is a good choice for the budget. if you have a bigger budget hourglass. Might be nice if you really want this extreme length. And I don't know, I probably just wouldn't recommend the other one based on the price point and that you're not going to really get the benefit from that peptide.
But I think what we're kind of saying here is these all kind of have the same technologies, and if they were all made by like a big company, they wouldn't cost that much different. I know having the pentapeptide in there is going to increase the price of that one, so it's a little bit more expensive. It's not 138 New Zealand dollars more expensive.
No,
so,
not at all.
There's a huge profit margin on these types of products anyway, which is why my advice to people whenever you're using cosmetics is that you should start with the lowest price stuff and then just graduate to higher price stuff until you find something you like that works the way you like it to, because low price stuff can work just as good as high price stuff.
That's a great strategy.
Yeah. Speaking of strategy, you hear that music?
Oh gosh, everyone, that's all we have time for today. If you get a chance, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. That's going to help other people find the show and ensure we have a full docket of beauty questions to answer.
And if you have a question, just record it on your smartphone and email it to thebeautybrains@gmail.com, and we can get your voice on the show. Speaking of the show, the Beauty Brains are on Patreon. If you like the fact that we do not have advertisements and we can just say whatever we like, you know, mostly, you can help support the show, because it's not free to do the show. We do have hosting costs and such, and you can go to patreon.com/thebeautybrains and subscribe at any level. You get a transcript of the show and you get a higher priority of answering your questions.
Also, don't forget to follow us on our various social media accounts. On Instagram, we're at TheBeautyBrains2018. On Twitter, we're at TheBeautyBrains. We have a Facebook page and a TikTok.
All right. Well, it was great seeing you again, Valerie.
Good to see you. I'm so glad we're keeping the weekly recording up.
We are.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. And remember, be brainy about your beauty.
Thanks, everyone. Kittens!